definition of the suffering human mind. We're all in it together. Nobody's left out. Of course, we have moments of freedom where we opt out. Very important. So, some reflections on the theme. I'm very grateful I can still see enough. Integrating insights. So I want to just start with a few quotes. I think of them as kind of fingers pointed at the moon. To kind of move around a little bit in this terrain of what is an insight. Because it'd be easy enough to think that we all know what I'm saying when I'm talking about having an insight, and probably a lot of us do, but there's also that gap between our intellectual conceptual understanding and the part of us that actually does live in the mystery. It's just like, insight, what is that? And I'm not talking about the doubting part that goes, I don't know if I've ever had one or had a big enough one. Just what is it? Somebody gave me the book right as I've come out of retreat, the Night Train to Lisbon. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to remember the author because I didn't know I was going to mention it. But it's this incredible novel set in Europe. A Swiss gentleman who, high school teacher who has a kind of a mysterious surprise circumstance walking on his way to school one morning, and out of that literally a series of events happen where he finds himself in Portugal. And this deep quest for self and for truth. And part of his muse for that quest was a writer, a book that he came across, the writer's name, Prado, something like that. I apologize, I wasn't going to mention this, but it's the perfect metaphor. And anyway, so I was reading some last night before I went to bed, and the writer was giving this example about how he woke up one morning, and he asked himself the question, what is a month? What does a month mean? What does it mean to have a month? And he started asking people in his life, what does a month mean? And one woman said, well, it means this many sunrises and sunsets. And somebody else said, oh, I remember this one time I took care of my daughter when she was sick for a month, and how many times I went up and down the stairs with the soup. And all these different answers to what is a month. After he had these dialogues and he was still working with this open question, this is very much a spiritual practice, working with open questions, working with the obvious and seeing them with new eyes. And he finally realized that he hadn't asked the right question. The question wasn't, what is a month? The question was, what makes this span of time that we call a month meaningful? And that took him in a totally different direction. What is an insight? Some people think they don't have insights. I won't torture you by asking for a show of hands. How many people here think you don't have insights? You're wrong. It's really rare, actually, that I'll say something like, you're wrong. But I genuinely believe it. I may be wrong, but I think you're wrong if you think that. Okay? One of the translations I'll use for insight for folks that feel like they don't have any is just, well, have we ever had an aha moment? And everybody has. And what is an aha moment? We're going along, and all of a sudden something shifts in our mind or our body or heart. Something shifts, and there's a space. And in relative time, it might be quite short space. And yet, there's incredible potency and power there. And everything starts to shift. And we go, aha! And all of a sudden, the view is changing. It just got unfrozen or unstuck or a new perspective, something. And it starts to inform experience moment by moment moving forward out of that gap. It's actually a perfectly acceptable way to talk about spiritual awakening itself. They're often gap moments, you know? And in that gap, something changes. And it starts to inform experience moving forward out of that gap. So, Carl Jung. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light. Okay, we've all got our imagination about what enlightenment means. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. The latter procedure, however, is disagreeable and therefore not popular. Okay. We're going to have to burn a little bit if we want to keep showing up here. And I'm not talking about this Dharma Center. I'm talking about showing up here. Here keeps going. We're going to have to burn a little bit to keep showing up here. An author, Julia J. Woodman. Enlightenment is not about cocooning oneself, but about integrating more fully with both yourself and your life. How many years did I sit the 2-month retreat at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, believing and hoping that if only I could live there forever in silence, I would be okay, i.e. get enlightened completely? Well, things didn't work out that way. I'm very glad that a more mature understanding of enlightenment carries a very, very important extra letter, which is an S, enlightenments, awakenings, insights. Richard Rohr, another author. You know after any truly initiating experience that you are part of a much bigger whole. Life is not about you henceforward, but you are about life. So what is an insight? Let's go to one of the scholars of our time, Tan Jeff, Tanisara Bhikkhu. He says, insight is not a matter of belief or contemplation. That's very important. Insight is not a matter of belief or contemplation. But insight is of direct seeing. Only with the actual seeing does there come a dramatic shift in the course of one's life and one's relationship to the Dhamma. So one could retranslate that. Only with actual seeing does there come a dramatic shift in the course of one's life and one's relationship to the truth, the nature of things. So a Zen saying, insight, awakening, enlightenments. I'm using all of these kind of on a continuum because some of us have actually had profound spiritual awakenings. And we don't talk about it. In part because we come out of monastic traditions where there are rules and regulations about not tooting your own horn about your awakening experiences, which is wise. But then it's gotten kind of solidified into this internalized legal system of I can't acknowledge that practice is progressing. Okay, practice progresses if we keep practicing. Mm-hmm. Maybe not how we thought it would, maybe not how we'd like it would, but it does. I mean, this is the promise of the path. It's not for somebody else. It's for us. So this Zen saying, enlightenment is not something you get, it's something you do. Insights are not something that we have, they're something that we manifest, would be the translation. Yeah. So types of insights, types of moments of clarity, aha, seems kind of different. So just a few examples, and I'm only naming a few. When we have the discussion, you can bring up more, and we can say yes and normalize, etc., right? But here are a few. And resource-wise, I'm not going to lean over because the mic will do that thing that the mic does. I'll hold it up at the end. But references. I'm always interested in being able to send people off with places where they can study more, practice more, weave it together. Jack Kornfield's old classic book, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. So at some point I went through this book and like looked at like what are all the different categories of insights and awakenings in this book. Because Jack was fascinated by this. You know why he wrote this book? Because he wanted to interview all the teachers and meditation masters and senior practitioners in this book who had these amazing experiences. And he wanted to talk with them about it. And so he figured, well, I'll just, you know, make it a book project. If you're Jack Kornfield, you can do that, you know. Anyway, we're grateful that he did because it really normalizes the range of what we can access. You know, from totally profound to ridiculously ordinary, it's all included. Nothing's better than the other. Yeah. So, doorway of the mind. We've got everything from transpersonal insights, accessing the kind of archetypal mind, archetypal worlds, transforming a habit pattern that's been running the way that we interact with people our whole life. And all of a sudden, it just starts to break down. Or some way, some kind of insight or awakening experience where ways that we've been guarding our heart or what level feelings are okay or not okay suddenly start to dissolve. More is available, which goes back to that quote, any initiating experience, you know that you're part of a much bigger whole. Things start to open up and break down. Sometimes it's psychological insight. We have these operating principles. They're called core beliefs in some psychological systems. Things like, I'm not good enough. It's not safe. I can't trust. I'm better than everyone. Whatever it is, these core operating principles. And they color our view, and we live internally, relationally, and in our world from these operating principles. Well, they don't last forever, but man, they can sure last a lot of decades. Have you noticed? And it makes me grateful I'm on the spiritual path. I don't want to live from these things for the rest of my life with no spaces, no gaps. Those kind of insights, those kind of awakenings, the body, have tremendous energetic awakenings of all kinds. Sometimes it's, you know, just some sort of unusual healing. I think to myself, I'm not a person who has a healing happen, but how did that just disappear? All kinds of ways that things free themselves up. You know, for some of us, the insight is actually dropping into inhabiting the body for the first time in our lives. Not the idea of it, but the direct experience of it. And that'll change everything. That's incredibly insightful. So, we have an insight. There's enough of a range there. Some sort of aha, letting go, awakening. And it's easy enough to have the belief. And I think the belief is backed up by the way that we teach Dharma and meditation in the West, by the way. It's easy enough to have the belief, okay, I've got it, that's it. So I get enlightened retirement now, right? Well, I mean, a few of you probably heard me tell this story. I was just devastated. One of the early times that there was a kind of a profound series of insights or shifts that moved through my system, you know, the life-changing type. And I just thought that I was going to get to rest. I was exhausted. I had worked so hard and I had suffered so much in this life, and it was like, oh, finally, I got it, the thing I always wanted. I hope, maybe, wait a second, why am I still acting like a jerk? I mean, it was just devastating. So sometimes there's a grieving process that actually has to happen when we realize what it means to be an awakening human being. Because it's all a verb. If you know any awakened human beings, full stop, will you please introduce me? Because everyone I know is in a verb form, awakening. So what happens is actually it's the beginning. It's the beginning of a new cycle. It's the beginning of a process that grows out of an understanding that's at a more mature, wiser, more open, whatever you want to call it, understanding than where we started the last cycle from. And there's entire trainings in Buddhist meditation that don't actually begin truly until there's been some form of awakening that's moved through the system. You know? I mean, everything's online now, so you can go read the teaching and you can probably get an online transmission in it these days. But truly, the path of these practices doesn't start until we've had some experience and some insight. Interesting. So I have this model I want to share with you. It's pretty simple, and it's a tripod. So we've got our two bases, and we've got our apex up here. And the model is ordinary over here, extraordinary up here, and ordinary over here. Okay. This is a basic model to kind of explore some more of this integrating insights. How do we allow these to more fully inform our lives? How do we get in relationship with the process of having insights? Because if we're not in relationship with the process of having insights, what happens is we hope that we have one, and then probably at some point, if we keep going, we will. And then we hope that we can keep it, and then we hope that we can be perfect forever and ever. That's kind of limited. So, ordinary, extraordinary, ordinary. We'll start with ordinary. This is just our ordinary mind walking along on our spiritual path. So, you know, unless you just started meditating today, we've been walking along, and so things have been cultivated, we've dropped stuff, things have been grown. This is just our level of ordinary, wherever we are right now. Okay? So then we develop from that ordinary to where there's extraordinary. It might be an extraordinary experience, or just we develop loving kindness to a level that we never thought we would experience in this life. It's not, you know, it's not like I had an amazing meditation experience, just like, wow, I hated myself, and now there's so much self-love. I never knew I would get here. Here I am. This is amazing. I hope I have it forever. Oh no, something happened. Now I hate myself again. Did I lose it? No, absolutely not. Okay, so we have extraordinary. Then we have ordinary, and this is the descent. This is a part that we don't really talk about very much, and there's very inadequate support for those of you that are long-term meditators. This concerns me. It's why I'm developing bodies of teachings on it. It's why I'm developing training programs for people who want that kind of ongoing support in their meditation path. So, example, okay? Let's say compassion this time, right? So, ordinary level compassion. And then we develop meditatively and otherwise. We do our psychological work, et cetera, et cetera. Wow, I'm actually able to be with this degree of suffering in myself and somebody else without being codependent, without shutting down. You know, there's like this very healthy sense of interconnectedness. It's not blocked off. It's not overmerged. This is amazing. You know? And in that connection, it can change our operating principles for life. Then we have to learn to live it because, oh, here's this other relationship where it's a little more difficult and I'm not feeling as connected. Did I lose that compassion? Now I'm sliding into codependence. Now I got to learn how to, you know, I can actually be more nuanced with boundary setting out of what I experienced from here. And now I'm working in the muck of learning how to live from a deeper place. Those words I don't really like because then it sounds like the rest of it's shallow or something. You know what I mean, though. Okay. Let's give a more traditional example, right? Ordinary. Let's talk about our sense of self. Ordinary. Okay, me and mine. And sometimes I get really attached to mine, and sometimes I get really obsessed with me. Okay, ordinary. Meditate, mindfulness, heart practices, regulate my nervous system, do a little bit more therapy, whatever it is, right? Go along the spiritual path. Sit some more retreats, whatever it is we do, okay? And then extraordinary. And, you know, we have these experiences where there isn't a solid separate sense of self. It all falls away. And it's just direct experience. And they happen. And sometimes they're short. And sometimes they're a little longer. Sometimes they last for hours or days. Sometimes they'll keep coming up in certain contexts repeatedly, even in our lives. Okay? Extraordinary. Right? And then we have to learn how to live it in an ordinary way, because this is ordinary. So from that experience, we can start to live from, oh yeah, this whole sense of self is a process happening to a system. I don't have to take it so seriously. I can bring more acceptance when I am taking it seriously. I can have some more patience, more clarity, more inspiration to keep going with the practice. Ordinary, right? So it's not just a tripod, of course, it circles. It goes like this. And the ordinary over here keeps getting more mature, but it circles. Okay. And the thing is the mind loves to kind of compare, if you noticed, quantify things. This one's better than this one. This one isn't good enough. I wish it lasted longer. Dot, da, 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 da. There's this wonderful line from Joseph Goldstein that I love to bring in when the mind is doing that dance. And, you know, this is somebody who's been meditating. Let's see. He started when he's 20. So for almost 55 years. Would you imagine there'd be a lot of insight there? Joseph Goldstein. He is the founding teacher of Insight Meditation Society on the East Coast. So what he says is, something happens, it's amazing. He goes, wow, it's the tip of the iceberg. It's always the tip of the iceberg. And I think about the inspiration that that evokes. Just like, wow, I just had this amazing meditation experience. I never knew that I could be so free. This is amazing. Wow. And then the sense of like potential, possibility. It's the tip of the iceberg. It's always the tip of the iceberg. Instead of I have to get it and keep it and be the A-plus student forever, it's a sense of possibility, of inspiration, of continuity. So I want to talk about a few themes of things that happen after we have the insight. Some of them will be resonant for you and some of them won't. Okay? So that's okay. And number one. We have an insight, an aha, an awakening, whatever, on the continuum. Number one, we do not have to figure it out. And we all know what the first thing the mind does when we have an amazing spiritual or emotional or mind or body experience, right? Is the mind jumps in and tries to figure it out. Why? I think it's something to be respected as part of the integration. Because often when we're deep, deep in direct experience, the conceptual mind is getting a little rest, is taking a break. There's a gap or a settling. It's not ruling us the way that it does most of the time. So then it roars back into the foreground and says, what about me? I don't want to get killed off here. You need me. So I'll do my job and figure out what that spiritual awakening was that you just had. Okay, makes sense. So here's where it gets nuanced. Number one is we don't have to figure it out. And we can acknowledge that the thinking, figuring out mind will be a part of this process. It will roar in and do its job. And we can say, sweetheart, you're doing your job perfectly. But we don't have to like let it run the process. Because somebody I talked to today was already describing this. We have an insight, and it feels really important to us. Something touches us. How about just something deeply touches us? And then the mind wants to get involved thinking, and what happens is we move further and further and further and further away from being touched. So we're chasing after it, and it's actually being chased away simultaneously. So on one hand, we don't have to figure it out. On the other hand, there's a very important and healthy process about at some point finding language and concepts that describe what we experienced. Because otherwise, we're leaving the conceptual mind out. And if it's about wholeness of freedom, if it's about wholeness of maturity, emotionally, mentally, then no part left out. We need the words, we need the concepts, but we need to be in relationship with them, right? Instead of them running us and telling us what to do, right? So this is where, how many of you sat residential retreats? I'm just curious. Okay. So maybe just more than half. This is where, even in a day long, it's true. You get done at the end and somebody who doesn't know anything about this or somebody who does, who wasn't there, says, how was it? You sort of got to figure out something to say. If you just look blankly, they'll think, wow, maybe they're in a cult or something. They just got woo-woo on me. I mean, it's California, but there's only so far you can take it. I have to be careful when I teach out of state, I'm always commenting, I'm like, okay, California cultural conditioning, guys. You invited a California teacher, you are having a cultural experience. In Europe, they loved it. And I loved them. I learned a lot. It's not about coming up with the thesis about what our insight was. It's coming up with the headline. Or instead of talking about conceptually, so let me come up with an insight, something specific. Okay, so very, very simple insight that I had during my retreat. Obviously, I had many. I was there for a while. But a very, very simple insight that I had. And insights are deceptively simple, and verbally, they're often embarrassingly obvious. So verbally, the insight I had was, wow, the body and the mind work exactly the same way. There is zero difference between these two systems. Okay, that was the insight. Now, I've had that insight before. I've had that conceptual knowledge before. That's the other thing about insights. They tend to revisit. Here's the cool thing. It doesn't matter. The ego goes, I want a new one. Direct experience goes, oh, resting in that ever more fully. Direct experience doesn't care if we've had it 50 times because it's resting in something rich and meaningful and that's supporting growth. So as an insight that I had, now I have to remember what I was using the insight as an example of. Who can help me?
Getting the headline.
The headline, thank you. Okay, sorry. I still am a little bit post-retreat. I think I'm linearly, am I doing good enough?
Yes.
I'm mostly, okay. It's hard to tell sometimes when you're just out of retreat. So I just gave the headline, right? That was one sentence about something that was actually really deep for me. Because the direct experience was this sense of zero separation between this physical and this kind of ephemeral. And really, really understanding that for all the overtraining that I have with my own mind, having meditated and trained all these years, I don't have that level and depth of training with the body. Those of you that know me know that I'm passionate about it and then I, really practice with it. But this sense of like, oh, I don't have to start at the beginning with this body. It's all coming along. It's all the same. There's just such a sense of ease and rest and trust and just like not much. It's just a little thing. And yet, it's not. And it doesn't matter what the insight was at all, because the direct experience is very similar no matter what the kind of content or the headline is, actually. So we don't need to figure it out, and it's important at a certain point, which does not need to be 30 seconds after we have the insight. It could be a day later, an hour later, 2 weeks later, to find some simple language and concepts so that we can have that as part of our wisdom headlines to refresh wise view over and over again, to remind ourselves what we know and what we care about, even if we don't have access to it right now. It matters. Next step, I call it rigorous honesty about the remaining defilements. Okay, so that's very technical. When I teach my own retreats, I'll do whole talks about this. But just simple headlines. So defilements, basically the ways we get caught, wanting, not wanting, confusion, delusion, all their permutations. Another way of saying it is rigorous honesty about the clinging and the struggle that remain. Because as much as we'd like to have an insight and never struggle or cling to anything again, that's not how it works. And in fact, even in the traditional stages of enlightenment, that's not how it works. Not going to do that teaching today. So clearly there's still more work to do. It's not insightful retirement. And so it's interesting because often one of the ways that I can identify with people, especially if I'm not working with them ongoing, and you're telling me about your practice and the cycle, and then you'll say, and now I'm really struggling with this fear or this greed or this dynamic in this relationship. And I'll get a whiff of something and I'll realize, oh, I think actually something shifted in your mind. And so now there's some deeper, more insidious level of conditioning or habituation, which is accessible. So what we'd like to have happen is an insight and what was Carl Jung and beings of light. You know, oh, now work is easy. Meetings, no problem. The news, don't need to titrate that at all, because I'm, enlightened, insightful. Anyway, now I'm making up words. That's not how it works. How it works is actually that. What I think of it is our conditioning has a deep root system. And with our habit patterns, sometimes they pop up above the surface in our thoughts, words, and actions. Habit patterns tend to, in the end, not be so helpful. Simply because they're habits. Okay? So we can have a habit that's helpful, but if it's our only way of doing things, it's limited. Does that make sense? Then we have the deep root system. And so what happens when we start to shift the sands of our sense of self is then the mind and the whole kind of awareness system can move down a level. And now we might be working with something psychologically or a habit pattern, or something comes up in terms of body patterns or dukkha difficulty that now has room to express itself because something else got cleared out. If we do not understand this, this is where I get so concerned about our Dharma, our big Dharma communities, because I see this too often, and it has almost happened to me as well. If we don't understand how this works, this is when we might start to doubt. And then the doubt glues itself to things. So we might doubt our own capacity to practice. We might doubt the teachings. We might doubt the teacher. We might doubt the center. It will glue itself to anything. It's shameless. Okay. Not saying that there aren't times when we need to doubt those things, but not in this circumstance. So that doubt creeps in, and we can actually take our foot off the accelerator of the spiritual work we're doing. You know, we can give up. We find ourselves not going to sitting group every week. It's just too hard. I'm too busy. Maybe not that retreat. It's like we think there's something wrong, so we back off. And the problem with that is then we're stuck. We're stuck in this stuff that wants to be met, that wants to be held, that wants to be understood and transformed, and yet we're not engaging it. There's no relationship. And I've seen way too many really good practitioners get stuck like this for way longer than necessary, including myself. So it's really important that we understand this. Ajahn Chah's got this great famous teaching. Sometimes I do it as a practice, but I'm just going to give it as a teaching right now. He says, Ajahn Chah, the kind of one of the founding teachers of the modern Thai Force tradition. So he says, when you let go a little, you have a little peace. When you let go a lot, you have a lot of peace. When you let go completely, you have complete peace. Okay, a little, a lot, completely. It's a process, right? So we need to stay with the process. We don't know when we have an insight or awakening whether it's necessarily letting go a little, a lot, or completely. We have to do this process from extraordinary to ordinary. And that process actually verifies what's been understood in our system. We cannot verify it conceptually. And if it's a profound enough insight, even our teachers will not verify it. They'll say, keep practicing. Okay, that's really limited. But what they mean by that is keep practicing and do this whole process that I'm just skimming the surface of, and things will verify it themselves. So one caveat that's been really, really important to me in terms of accepting the process, trusting the process. There are times when we let go of something. Maybe it's something relational or something that we're locked in about with our job or our body or something. You know, choose your thing. And it starts to transform, and then it just feels like it's released. It's like, wow, I'm not living from that anymore. Fill in your own blank. I'm just not living from that anymore. Here's the caveat. Sometimes I think we let go of something completely, except if life throws us the perfect storm of horrific triggering circumstances. I've seen that. I've seen that in myself, where it's like something transforms about the way that I relate to myself as a sense of self. It's just not stuck anymore. It's not solid or separate anymore. But man, if you throw in the job nightmare, the relationship nightmare, the health nightmare, the political nightmare, and the financial nightmare all at once, it'll default into the old pattern. This does not mean that there wasn't transformation. What it means is we had the perfect storm. And what happens in that case, if we understand that and don't get stuck in this little eddy of, oh, I thought I had it, but I was wrong. None of it counts. I thought I was this great meditator, but, you know, whatever your voice says, you can now hear what my voice says. Instead of this eddy, which just goes nowhere, it's just like washer cycle of eddy here, we go, oh, perfect storm of life circumstances. And we can recognize it. And, you know, we don't stay stuck as long. We can bring our kind of more mature level of understanding to bear. And it releases much more easily. It might have taken 10 years to get there to begin with, but it takes 10 minutes to get out of it again. That's amazing. You think that's amazing? Mm-hmm. I just find that phenomenal. It's like, wow. So it take me, you know, 5 weeks of therapy to get there, and now I just need to like take a few mindful breaths and I'm okay, you know? All right. Couple of other things. We do not need to become the person who is more clear, more free, and more awake. Do you know what I mean by that? We do not need to become that person. So So I can't talk about this without talking about spiritual bypass. Very important concept. If I can find it, here it is. So spiritual bypass is the term coined by psychologist and Dharma teacher John Wellwood. He lives in Marin. He introduced this term 30 years ago now, more than that. He says, spiritual bypassing is a term I coined to describe a process I saw happening in the Buddhist community I was in, and also in myself. Although most of us were sincerely trying to work on ourselves, I noticed a widespread tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. Okay. I started meditating when I was 17. I had some unfinished developmental tasks. Okay. And one of the ones that really stuck me was renunciation versus the core belief, I don't need anything. Can you see how that might play out? So I got to look like a really great young spiritual practitioner. I don't need anything. I'm fine. I'm renouncing, simplifying. And actually, what I was not doing was finishing the developmental task of getting in touch with what my needs actually were. In a healthy way, okay? We don't need to become the person who's more clear, more free, more awake. Because if we become that person and try to present that person, then we're not allowed to be authentic anymore. We have to look like that thing all the time, the same way as the rest of our identities that we carry around and don't want anybody to see that I'm not actually like that. So we don't want to do that with our spiritual identities. It's way easier said than done. This is where a teacher and some good psychotherapy are very important. All right. Let's see. I'm not keeping time very well, but okay. So next is this dynamic of teasing apart the selfing and the clinging and the natural impulse and intention to integrate our ahas, the things that touched us. We want to live them. We do. Like in our deepest heart of hearts, we want to live them. And we want to keep them. And we want to control them. And we want to make them look good. And all of this. So teasing this whole apart, I look for the thought, after I have an insight, I want to live my whole life like this. That's a very tricky thought because it has so much beauty and so much important intention and so much potential to make a project out of it and to control it and to struggle with it. So a couple of tools with this. The first one is intention, that we can actually say, okay, there was an insight, and I have the intention to live this in my life. Intention rests in the mystery. It's not a goal. We can't make it happen. It's very different than fantasy. It's very different than hoping and fearing. I hope I can live my whole life like this, but I fear that I can't because the political situation just makes it so that I can't. Or, you know, my kids make it so that I can't, or whatever. We'll fill in our own blank. The intention, and to return to that intention every day and every time that thing comes up. I want to live from that insight, but I'm just living from my habits. All right, reset. And then the other piece is developing wisdom reminders, you know, and that's why we need the language that we can use regularly in our daily life. So a couple of them that I share with you guys a lot when I'm teaching, things like, may I trust in the unfolding? Here's this wanting. Here's this intention. Here's the wisdom reminder. May I trust in the unfolding? Another wisdom reminder I developed out of an insight I had is everything is everywhere. There's just some cute little wisdom headline that reminded me about the insight I'd had about interdependence. Everything is everywhere. So it's almost like a kind of a secret code in our own mind. It doesn't have to make sense to anybody but us, because it's just reminding us of what we know that we might not have access to right this second. So ordinary, extraordinary, ordinary, extraordinary, ordinary. Ordinary over here is not ordinary over here. I hope you got that. Okay? Because what's the difference? This is just ordinary. This is an insight or an aha, or we got touched by something. This ordinary is informed by extraordinary. But it means that we're normal. I remember the first time I sat a retreat with a Tibetan teacher. At the end of the retreat, he said, pith advice for meditators, be normal. He said, if you had a profound retreat, don't act strangely. Be normal, please. He said, people come to me and say, Rinpoche, you know, people come off your retreats and they're acting very strange. He's like, please, for me, be normal. Okay, but it's good advice. Ordinary. We're just living our lives. We don't need to be the person who had a profound awakening. We don't need to have everybody know we had a profound insight. We're just raising our kids and doing our work and serving in our communities and being in traffic on the freeway and living our lives, you know? Ordinary. But it's informed by something, and that something is a gift. It is something that no one and nothing can take away from us. In this world where, like, everything's just slipping through our fingers, and it's so unstable, and it's so insecure, you know? There are levels where it's just, like, there's a gift, you know? It's refuge. So in my early years of meditation, one of my big spiritual fears was that I would lose my insights, that I would forget. And I was afraid because, you know, I wasn't perfect. I was afraid because I still had a lot of growing to do. I hadn't heard the tip of the iceberg model, still have a lot of growing to do. And there were a lot of reasons why I was scared. I was scared of the suffering that would come if I forgot. We've all got reasons why we're scared we'll forget. And the thing that made it even worse, I know I'm not the only one, is that there were times that it felt like I did forget. Sometimes I remember just enough to remember that I wanted to be remembering something, but that was it. And it was really painful. I had to grieve. So grieving is a part of moving from ordinary, extraordinary to ordinary for some of us. Real grieving process sometimes. To talk about that another day on. And I remember my teacher's voices saying, at the end of every retreat, you will forget all this. Like the despair, the pain in my heart. And then they'd say, and you will remember. And I think, what the hell do they mean by that? Well, now I know. Because it's not about remembering the way that we remember. You know, the perfect day at the beach is a memory, or you know, this to-do list, remember every detail. Conceptually, it's not about that. It's a different kind of remembering. And one of the ways I was trained by my teacher from Thailand, maybe we'll play with this a little bit, the next guided meditation, is actually he would say, when something very, very deep moved through me, he would say, Heather, remember back. I talked to the translator. I'm like, remember back? I thought we were supposed to be in the present. Right? I'm like, ask Aslan Poor, please, what remember back. What does this mean? And so then we go back and forth with the translator. And finally what I understood was remember back means that actually in the timeless, everything is present. So we can access direct experience here and now that we can't necessarily access through the memory-oriented conceptual mind. So that probably went over a few heads. We'll play with indirect experience and see if it lands in a different way when we do the next meditation. I guess the point is that even if we intellectually forget every insight we've ever had, It's still in here. It's in ourselves. That's probably what's important. Closing quote by Chinese master Su Yong. He uses the word satori, and satori is one of many words that's an indicator of awakening or deep insight. There are many minor satoris. I'm just going to use the word insight to make it very, very, you don't have to like work with your mind. You can just take this in. There are many minor insights before a major insight. And there are many major insights on the path of genuine awakening. It's the tip of the iceberg. It's always the tip of the iceberg. That used to depress me. Now it inspires me. No. So let's take it out on the walking path. Again, remembering what I was saying about like, okay, whatever you took from this is what you took from this. You don't have to remember it all. It doesn't all have to make sense. You just go out on the path, put your feet on the earth, sense the quality of the temperature of the air, the movement of the air, and just see what reveals itself. You're not looking for anything. Can be just as simple as feeling a footstep on the earth. That's what reveals itself. But it's a direct experience.